Imagine this. You've just flown like 14 hours across the Pacific. You're completely jet lagged.
Oh, yeah, your knees are completely locked up.
Exactly. And you've immediately hopped into a rental car, right? And you drive another, I don't know, 3 hours deep into the scorching red dirt of the Australian outback.
It's just endless red dirt.
Endless. So you finally arrive at your highly anticipated desert resort. You hand over your credit card to the tune of like $400 a night.
Which is not cheap, by the way.
Not at all. And you walk into a room that the locals on Reddit affectionately describe as a quote, Soviet-style motel.
That's such a bleak description.
Right. The air conditioning sounds like a dying tractor. A tiny bottle of water costs more than a decent glass of wine back home.
And the kicker is the hiking, right?
Yeah, so you came to see this famous hiking trail, and it's literally locked behind a steel gate at 10 in the morning.
Because, well, the ambient temperature out there is essentially a death sentence by noon.
Exactly. It's just this stark, incredibly uncomfortable moment when the glossy travel brochure violently collides with, logistical reality.
Yeah, you realize you aren't paying for luxury at all. You're just paying for the privilege of not dying of exposure in the middle of the desert.
It's true. And today, that is precisely the illusion we are shattering. So, welcome to another deep dive into the source material.
We are so glad you're here.
Yeah, and if you are sitting there right now with like a $2,000 non-refundable ticket to Sydney or Cairns, don't panic.
No, don't panic. But maybe listen very, very closely.
Yes, because today's mission is highly specific. We are here to save you time, we're going to save you money, and honestly, most importantly, your sanity.
Absolutely. We are stripping away all those, fake Instagram filters and really looking at the deeply engineered, incredibly lucrative mechanics of the Australian tourist trap.
It's a massive industry, and to do this, we are synthesizing a really highly curated stack of material today.
Oh, it's a mountain of data. We are looking at this incredible deep dive analytical report that actually pulled data from over 20 million Google reviews.
20 million. That's just wild.
Right. And we're cross-referencing that with these brutally candid Reddit threads written by local Australians.
The people who actually have to live in these heavily marketed zones.
Exactly. Plus, we've got extensive articles from seasoned travel economists. We're getting way past the marketing copy and looking at the cold, hard data.
Okay, let's unpack this because we aren't just going to sit here and like read you a boring list of places to avoid.
Right, that wouldn't be very helpful.
No, it's boring. We are going to look at the exact mechanisms of why these traps exist in the first place. Like, how does a pristine beach become a polluted nightmare?
Or how does a historic town just, turn into a tacky shopping mall?
Exactly. And more importantly, we are going to give you the exact hidden authentic alternatives that the locals actually use.
Because, the goal here isn't just to critique Australia, right?
No, not at all.
The underlying mechanics we are going to discuss today, so we're talking corporate monopolies, the economics of isolation, social media algorithms dictating physical infrastructure, these apply globally.
Yeah, it happens everywhere.
Right. Once you understand the anatomy of a tourist trap here, you will be able to spot these exact same red flags in literally any country you visit.
So true. Okay, so I'm looking at the data on our first location, and the sheer audacity of the pricing model is just, it's staggering to me.
Oh, I know exactly which one you're going to start with.
You know it. I want to start in the absolute heart of the Sydney concrete jungle, the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
The iconic bridge.
Right. Now, the bridge climb is marketed globally as this absolute undeniable rite of passage. Like, you have to do
Oh,
it.
yeah, every celebrity has done it. Oprah did it.
Exactly. But you look at the actual breakdown of this experience, and you are staring down a price tag of $300 to over $400 per person.
Which is a huge chunk of a travel budget.
A massive chunk. And for that premium, you are forced to strip off your normal clothes, put on this drab, completely unflattering gray jumpsuit.
Don't forget the breathalyzer test.
Well, right. You have to blow into a breathalyzer. And then they enforce a total zero tolerance ban on personal
You
cameras.
can't even take your phone out of your pocket. They lock it away.
Right. It is quite literally this highly regimented march up a steel arch.
Yeah, you are paying a premium luxury rate for an experience that honestly feels remarkably like processing at a medium security facility.
That's exactly what it feels like. But okay, hold on. I have to play devil's advocate and offend the bridge operators for just a second here.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because looking at this ban on personal cameras, I mean, isn't that just a baseline safety necessity?
How do you mean?
Well, you've got thousands of cars commuting on the highway directly beneath the arch, right?
Right. It's a major traffic artery.
So if some tourist fumbles an iPhone while trying to get a selfie up there, that phone reaches terminal velocity and goes straight through the windshield of a Honda Civic below.
Yeah, that would be a genuine hazard.
Like a lethal projectile. So the ban makes sense.
Well, what's fascinating here is not the safety regulation itself, but how that completely valid safety regulation is seamlessly weaponized for corporate profit.
Weaponized? How?
Well, you are absolutely right about the physics. A dropped phone is dangerous. But look at the economic ecosystem that safety rule creates.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Because you are physically barred from documenting your own experience, you become a captive audience.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. If you want any visual proof that you actually did this $400 climb, you are forced to purchase a single corporate-branded souvenir photo from the operator.
Let me guess, it's not cheap.
It's an additional $25 to $35 a pop.
Oh my God, it's the ultimate closed loop.
Exactly. What we are witnessing is the extreme corporatization of a public monument. I mean, the Sydney Harbor Bridge is a state-owned piece of critical infrastructure, right?
Yeah, the taxpayers built it.
Taxpayers built it and maintain it. Yet, a private entity was granted a virtual monopoly on the commercial experience of climbing its main arch.
That's crazy when you think about it.
And when you have zero market competition and a totally captive audience, you can dictate entirely unreasonable terms. You dictate the uniform, and you artificially inflate the price of memories.
But here is where the local Reddit threads are just pure gold. Because reading through this, there is a vastly superior, dirt-cheap alternative sitting literally attached to the exact same bridge.
Yes, the locals love this spot.
It's called the Pylon Lookout. Have you been to this?
I have, actually. It's fantastic.
It's located inside the massive concrete southeast pylon of the bridge, right? And for just $19, not $400, you get to climb like 200 steps up.
And you experience essentially the exact same stunning panoramic view of the Opera House in the harbor.
Exactly. And guess what? You can take your phone.
Yes.
You can take a DSLR camera. You can take as many photos as your memory card can physically hold.
The economics behind why the Pylon Lookout is so cheap are actually a perfect case study in contractual obligations.
Really? How so?
So the same parent company that operates the massively expensive bridge climb, they actually operate the Pylon Lookout as well.
Wait, really?
Yep, same company.
But why? I mean, if the same company is selling a $400 ticket and a $19 ticket right next to each other, why wouldn't they just jack up the price of the pylon?
Because they legally can't. It is a strict condition of their concession contract with the government body, the Roads and Maritime Services.
Oh, the RMS?
Right. The RMS basically mandated that the operating company must maintain this low-cost, highly accessible public entry point in exchange for the lucrative, exclusive rights to operate the main arch climb.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It's essentially a required public concession.
Exactly.
It's like a loss leader in retail. It's the cheap hot dog at Costco that keeps the ecosystem running while they sell you the premium electronics in the back.
That's a great analogy, yeah. But here is the critical mechanism at play here. Because the operating company is naturally not financially motivated to promote a $19 ticket when they could be funneling tourists toward a $400 ticket.
Right. They want the big money.
Exactly. So the marketing budget for the Pylon Lookout is virtually non-existent.
I noticed that. I was looking for it online.
For years, their website was notoriously difficult to navigate. You practically had to stumble upon the physical entrance by accident, just walking across the bridge.
It's like corporate neglect as a historic preservation tool.
Yeah, kinda.
Because they don't want you to know about it, it remains this quiet, uncrowded haven where you can just walk up at your own pace.
No breathalyzers required.
No breathalyzers. But, you know, if a single corporation can figure out how to monopolize a massive steel bridge, it's almost impressive how the global travel industry has managed to monopolize and, frankly, ruin a completely fluid natural environment.
You're talking about the beaches.
I am. I'm looking at the data on Australia's beaches, and the dissonance between the global reputation and the local reality is just staggering.
Yeah, you're referring to what we call the beach brand myth.
Absolutely. Let's look at Bondi Beach in Sydney. On paper, it's arguably the most famous strip of sand in the Southern Hemisphere.
It's a global icon.
It is. But if you read these candid reviews and the local warnings, it is described as a chaotic, polluted trap.
Completely overcrowded.
Yeah, you have thousands of people packed elbow to elbow on the sand. The adjacent bars and restaurants are charging exorbitant, hyperinflated prices for, honestly, mediocre food.
And physically, the beach itself is quite dangerous.
Yeah, the data highlights this notorious, highly dangerous rip current right in the middle that the local lifeguards darkly refer to as the Backpacker Express.
And that nickname, it exists for a very specific hydrodynamic reason.
Oh, yeah. What's the science there?
So tourists look at the water and they see a calm patch between the breaking waves. And they naturally think, oh, that looks safe. There are no crashing waves there.
That makes intuitive sense.
Right. But that calm patch is actually the rip current. It's a powerful, narrow channel of fast-moving water pulling directly out to sea.
Oh, wow. So they're walking right into the trap.
Exactly. Locals know how to read the water. Tourists just follow the marketing. They jump into the calm patch, and they immediately require a taxpayer-funded jet ski rescue.
That is terrifying. Just completely terrifying. And then you look south to Melbourne, and you see a very similar but somehow even grimmer phenomenon at St. Kilda Beach.
Oh, St. Kilda.
St. Kilda is relentlessly marketed as this idyllic bohemian seaside paradise, but the millions of aggregated reviews paint a completely different picture.
It's quite rough.
Rough is an understatement. We are talking about consistent complaints of aggressive, intoxicated crowds, people finding used syringes buried in the sand.
Yeah, that's a huge issue there.
And getting blasted by freezing Antarctic winds, not to mention swimming in water that frequently tests positive for dangerously high levels of E. coli bacteria.
And the E. coli issue is a perfect example of infrastructure failing to support a brand.
How does that happen exactly? Where is it coming from?
Well, Melbourne is a massive sprawling city, right? And a significant portion of its aging stormwater drainage system empties directly into Port Phillip Bay, which is right near St. Kilda.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So when there is heavy rainfall, all the oil, animal waste, and surface pollution from the city streets is flushed straight into the shallow waters of the beach.
So you are literally swimming in city runoff just for the sake of the postcard photo.
Precisely. This is a textbook example of what the French philosopher Jean Baudrillard called a simulacrum.
A simulacrum. Define that for us.
It's essentially a copy of a reality that no longer actually exists.
Okay, I follow.
So places like Bondi and St. Kilda, they have ceased to be functional, relaxing local ecosystems. They have been entirely transformed into global hollow brands.
Sorry, it's just a name now.
People aren't flying to Bondi to enjoy the restorative properties of the ocean, you know. They are going to Bondi to participate in the brand of Bondi.
They are there to take the photo that proves they are at the famous place.
Exactly. And what happens is that the physical reality of the space, the water quality, the local amenities, the safety, it completely collapses under the immense, unnatural weight of that brand name.
The reality simply cannot sustain the myth.
Right. It just breaks down.
No, it's like buying a high-end designer shirt that is actively falling apart at the seams. Like, the fabric is itchy, doesn't even fit you, but you refuse to take it off simply because it has the right logo stitched on the pocket.
That's a perfect way to look at it. You are wearing the brand, not the shirt.
Right. So if you want the actual, authentic Australian beach experience, where does the data say you should actually go?
Well, the locals are remarkably consistent on this across all the forms. In Sydney, you just skip Bondi entirely.
Don't even bother.
Don't bother. Instead, you head down to Circular Quay and catch the public ferry over to Manly Beach.
Oh, I've heard the ferry ride is amazing.
It is. The ferry ride itself is incredibly scenic. You pass right by the Opera House, and then Manly offers a much larger, way better regulated surf environment.
And it has a community that actually lives there, right?
Yes. Or, if you want something even quieter, without the heavy surf, you check out Balmoral Beach. Or there's this highly secluded spot called Parsley Bay.
Parsley Bay. I haven't heard of that one.
They are tucked away inside the harbor and offer this pristine, really calm water. Great for families.
And what about down in Melbourne? What's the alternative to the E. coli at St. Kilda?
Ditch St. Kilda completely. Head over to Williamstown Beach in the western suburbs.
Williamstown. Okay.
It has a much cleaner, more authentic local vibe. It's got better water circulation, and you actually get a stunning, uninterrupted view of the Melbourne city skyline right across the water.
That sounds infinitely better. Now, it's relatively easy for me to wrap my head around how a beach located directly inside a major, densely populated metropolis becomes a crowded, polluted trap.
Right. City beaches are naturally prone to overcrowding simply due to proximity.
Exactly. There are just millions of people right there. But I'm looking at our sources on regional towns, and what is truly alarming is how this exact same brand-driven gentrification is infecting remote, isolated coastal areas that used to be completely untouched.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we are talking about the complete financialization of a town's quote-unquote vibe.
Yes, financializing a vibe. Which brings us to the tragedy of Byron Bay in New South Wales.
Oh, Byron Bay. What a case study.
Seriously. For decades, historically, Byron was famous for being this progressive, incredibly laid-back, working-class surfer haven. It was like a hippie commune.
It was a true countercultural epicenter in Australia.
Right. But you look at the data today, it is a gridlocked nightmare. Sources say it routinely takes up to 45 minutes just to find a single parking spot near the beach.
It's just traffic everywhere.
And if you finally park and you just want to grab a standard local tap beer, a schooner, as they call it, at the iconic local beach hotel, you're going to be handing over $16.
Which is astronomical.
$16 for a basic glass of beer.
Well, what we are observing in Byron Bay is a severe, highly accelerated case of economic and cultural displacement.
Displacement.
Yeah. The original culture, so the artists, the surfers, the working class families who organically created the very bohemian vibe that made the town famous in the first place, they've been entirely priced out and pushed out.
But how exactly does that happen so fast, though? I mean, does the town just wake up one day and decide to charge $16 for a beer?
No, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens through algorithmic real estate and elite capital.
Talk me through that.
As Byron's reputation grew, it started attracting high-net-worth individuals and celebrity compounds.
Like the Chris Hemsworth effect, if you will.
Exactly. The Hemsworth effect is a huge part of it. But even more damagingly, it attracted aggressive institutional Airbnb investors.
Well, right. The short-term rentals.
Yeah. Investors buy up the local housing stock to flip into short-term holiday rentals. And this completely chokes the long-term rental market.
So there's nowhere for locals to actually live.
Right. The local hospitality workers, the people who actually pour the beers, clean the hotel rooms, run the surf shops, they can no longer afford to live within 50 kilometers of the town.
Oh, wow. So they have to commute in.
Yes. And because of that, businesses have to pay massive wage premiums just to get staff to commute that far. And those costs, they're passed directly onto the consumer.
Resulting in the $16 beer.
Exactly.
It represents the ultimate paradox of modern tourism. Millions of people flock to a destination specifically to experience an authentic, laid-back vibe, and the sheer volume of their money and their physical presence systematically destroys the exact vibe they came to experience.
It's tragic, really. They are loving it to death.
Loving it to death. And this destructive mechanism isn't limited to whole towns. It applies to specific geological features as well, right?
Yes, primarily through what we can call the superlative trap.
Oh, this is fascinating. Let's look at Jervis Bay, which is a few hours south of Sydney, specifically a place called Hyams Beach.
A very famous spot.
Right. If you open any travel blog or scroll through Instagram, Hyams Beach is relentlessly marketed using one very specific phrase, the whitest sand in the world.
Supposedly, it's even in the Guinness Book of Records.
Sounds amazing, right? Like, who wouldn't want to see that? But the local sources describe a literal logistical apocalypse.
That's a good way to put it.
Because of that one specific superlative, thousands upon thousands of tourists descend on this tiny residential street every single summer day.
It's just a small neighborhood road.
Right. The narrow access roads become completely dangerously blocked. Emergency vehicles can't even get through, and there is literally only one public toilet facility for thousands of people.
It creates a biological and infrastructural nightmare that completely shatters any possible serenity of being in nature. I mean, you have people queuing for an hour just to use a bathroom.
But I have to push back here, because if I'm planning a trip, if it truly, scientifically, has the whitest sand in the entire world, isn't it worth putting up with a little inconvenience or waiting in line just to get that once-in-a-lifetime photo? I mean, it's a world record.
Well, this raises an important question about how we fundamentally make our travel decisions and why we are so easily manipulated by marketing.
Manipulated how?
You have to be incredibly wary of superlative marketing. Whenever a location is branded with an est, you know, the biggest, the whitest, the oldest, the tallest, it stops being an environment and becomes a commodity.
It's just a product on a shelf.
Right. It acts as a massive magnet for tick-the-box tourists.
Tick-the-box tourists. What does that mean?
Visitors who aren't there to actually immerse themselves in the environment or understand the geology or even relax, they're there simply to extract a photograph that serves as social proof that they witnessed the superlative.
Ah, social proof. It's an extraction economy of imagery.
Exactly. Now, the sand at Hyams Beach is beautiful. It's highly refined quartz sand that actually squeaks when you walk on it.
I've heard about the squeaking sand.
But the hyperfixation on the marketing tagline has destroyed the actual ecosystem of the visit. You aren't experiencing the beach. You're experiencing a traffic jam next to some nice sand.
And here is the absolute most ironic part about this, according to the local data. Nature doesn't draw hard borders.
No, it definitely doesn't.
The sand doesn't just magically stop at the Hyams Beach property line. The local experts point out that you can just take what's called the White Sands Walk,
which is a beautiful trail.
Yeah, and just a few kilometers north of Hyams, you will find Tinemans Beach, you'll find Greenfield Beach, which, by the way, has excellent facilities if you're traveling in a camper van, and Blenheim Beach.
All in the exact same bay.
They share the exact same geological coastline. They feature the exact same stunning turquoise water and the exact same blindingly white, squeaky quartz sand.
But because they don't have the quote-unquote whitest sand in the world, marketing tagline officially attached to them.
The tick-the-box tourists ignore them completely.
Which leaves them completely pristine for the locals. You get total peace, quiet, and actual serenity.
And just to close the loop on Byron Bay, if you want to skip the gridlock and the elite celebrity gentrification entirely there, the locals highly recommend heading a bit further south into New South Wales to a coastal town called Yamba.
Yamba is fantastic.
Yeah, it is frequently described in the sources as what Byron Bay was 20 years ago. You get world-class surf breaks, a genuinely relaxed working-class community, and you won't need to take out a second mortgage to buy a beer at the Pacific Hotel.
It is a recurring theme we are seeing in all this data. The true value of a destination almost always lies just outside the perimeter of the primary marketing campaign.
Exactly. Look just outside the spotlight. But, it's not just pristine beaches and hippie towns being ruined by the crush of crowds and commercialization. I want to shift gears because the data gets pretty depressing when we look at how the tourism industry treats Australia's highly unique, world-renowned wildlife.
Yeah, this is a particularly sensitive area because you are dealing with living ecosystems rather than just geology or infrastructure.
Right. So let's talk about the famous Phillip Island Penguin Parade down in Victoria.
Sounds so cute on paper.
The marketing pitch is incredibly heartwarming. It says you get to sit by the ocean at dusk and watch these adorable tiny little penguins emerge from the surf and just waddle up the beach to their burrows.
Like a David Attenborough documentary come to life.
Exactly. But the reality on the ground is highly industrialized.
Industrialized is the perfect word for it.
Right. The sources describe a scene where you are packed onto massive tiered concrete grandstands alongside like 2,000 other tourists.
It feels like you're at a sporting event, not in nature.
Yeah. There is constant commercial noise. There are loudspeaker announcements. And the absolute worst part, despite strict, highly publicized rules against it, a significant portion of the crowd is constantly violating the no flash photography rule.
And that isn't just an annoyance for the people around them. It is a serious biological hazard for the animals.
Right, because these penguins have been hunting in the dark ocean all day.
Exactly. Little penguins have highly sensitive retinas that are adapted specifically for low light underwater vision.
Makes sense.
So when they emerge onto the beach in the pitch dark and a tourist fires off a smartphone camera flash directly into their eyes, it can cause severe disorientation.
That's awful.
They get essentially blinded, making them highly vulnerable to predators, or they're simply unable to find their chicks in the burrows.
Wow.
It's a highly distressing, chaotic environment for an animal that is just trying to return home to feed its young.
And the crowds just don't care because they need the photo for social media.
Sadly, yes.
But it's not just wild encounters that are problematic. It's the purely financial side of captive wildlife tourism, too, which is perfectly exemplified in our data by Australia Zoo up on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland.
Right, the home of the late, great Steve Irwin.
Exactly. It has massive global name recognition. But today, if you look at the pricing structure, just to walk through the front gates, a basic adult ticket will run you nearly $77.
That's just for general admission.
Right. That just gets you in the door to look at animals from a distance. If you actually want an interactive experience, say you want to get up close and pat a koala or feed a red panda, They nickel and dime you for every single specific encounter.
And those encounters are not cheap.
No. Depending on the animal, that can cost you anywhere from an additional $30 to a staggering $190 extra.
What's fascinating here is the inherent, almost unsolvable conflict of interest embedded deeply within modern corporate ecotourism.
Break that down for me. How is it a conflict of interest?
Well, on one hand, a venue like Australia Zoo ostensibly exists with a noble mission, right? To promote ecological conservation, fund wildlife hospitals, and educate the public on animal welfare.
Sure, that is the legacy it was built upon.
But on the other hand, it operates as a massive corporate entity with massive overhead costs. It must constantly maximize its commercial capacity and its revenue streams just to survive, pay its hundreds of staff, and grow its infrastructure.
So the conservation needs money, and to get money, you essentially have to commercialize the animals.
Precisely. And in the case of Australia Zoo, our analytical sources strongly question whether the venue has crossed the invisible line from, you know, funding conservation into the excessive, highly calculated commercial exploitation of Steve Irwin's media legacy purely for profit.
I can see that argument.
Yeah. When the baseline cost of entry becomes prohibitive to an average family and every single authentic tactile interaction is placed behind a steep secondary paywall, the core educational mission is severely compromised.
It ceases to be an educational sanctuary and basically becomes an incredibly expensive theme park.
Exactly.
But fear not, because the locals have provided incredible ethical alternatives that won't bankrupt you.
Yes, there are always alternatives.
If you want to see penguins in the wild without the concrete grandstands, the loudspeaker announcements, and the entry fees, you can literally just head to the St. Kilda Breakwater in Melbourne.
Oh, I've heard of that colony.
Yeah, there is a wild colony that lives right there in the rocks. Or if you are already on Phillip Island, skip the paid parade and drive out to the boardwalks at the Nobbies at sunset. You can watch them return to their burrows for free in their actual natural habitat.
That sounds vastly superior, and for wildlife parks that feel less like a corporate shakedown and more focused on the animals.
The sources highly recommend the Lone Pine Koala Sanctuary in Brisbane, which is much more reasonably priced and focused. Or there's a Currumbin Wildlife Sanctuary on the Gold Coast, which has a fantastic free lorikeet feeding experience that doesn't put up those secondary paywalls.
That's great to know. You know, it's interesting. Trapping animals behind glass or fencing them into interactive monetized zones is a known issue.
Yeah.
But what is truly remarkable and concerning from an environmental standpoint is how the Australian tourism industry has managed to put vast, wild, ancient geological landscapes behind a paywall and a velvet rope, too.
Which brings us perfectly into the geography trap. I want to dive straight into the Great Barrier Reef.
A big one.
This is arguably Australia's biggest international draw. Specifically, I'm looking at the data on a highly marketed, incredibly popular day trip destination called Green Island, which is located just a short boat ride off the coast of Cairns.
Green Island is everywhere in the brochures.
Right, and the brochures for Green Island show these vibrant, neon-colored, teeming coral reefs with sea turtles gliding past. But the synthesis of local reviews and marine environmental reports reveals a vastly, almost tragically different story.
What's the reality on the ground? Or in the water, I should say.
Green Island's home reef is frequently described by visitors as, quote, near dead. We are talking about areas suffering from as little as 0 to 5% live coral cover.
0 to 5%. That is effectively a marine graveyard.
And the water quality. The reviews constantly complain it's frequently murky, cloudy, and churned up. Why is a tropical reef murky?
Well, this raises an important question about exactly how we, as a global industry, are consuming geography.
Consuming geography. I like that phrase.
What you are seeing at Green Island is not a single point of failure. It is the compound, devastating result of multi-year impacts.
Like what?
First, you have intense anthropogenic impacts, meaning human-caused damage. When you have a constant daily barrage of heavy, diesel-spewing tourist ferries and glass-bottom boats churning the shallow waters, it kicks up massive amounts of sediment that blocks sunlight from the coral.
Oh, so the coral can't photosynthesize.
Right. Add in the physical damage of dropping boat anchors and the chemical slick of thousands of tourists wearing non-reef-safe sunscreen.
It just suffocates the whole ecosystem.
Yes, and that is just the human element. Combine that with natural disasters like warming oceans causing coral bleaching, tropical cyclones physically smashing the reef structure, and, of course, the devastating outbreaks of the crown of thorns starfish.
Oh, I've read about those. They literally eat the reef, right?
It's quite graphic, biologically speaking.
Tell me.
The crown of thorns starfish climbs onto a patch of healthy coral It physically extrudes its stomach out of its own mouth, wraps its stomach over the coral polyps, and secretes digestive enzymes that liquefy the living coral tissue.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it absorbs the nutrients and leaves behind nothing but a bleached white skeleton.
That is horrifying. And because Green Island is so close to the mainland, it just gets hit the hardest by all of this.
Exactly. These combined factors have completely decimated the easily accessible shallow inner reefs, which has effectively forced the tourism industry into an arms race, pushing high-speed boats further and further out into the deep ocean to find the remaining healthy ecosystems to show tourists.
Wow. And it's not just the fragile ocean ecosystems being commodified, it's the rugged coastline, too. Look at the famous 12 Apostles down in Victoria.
Yes. The iconic limestone stacks.
Right, these massive limestone pillars rising out of the Southern Ocean. The standard, heavily promoted day trip departing from Melbourne involves being packed into a large tour bus for 10 to 12 grueling hours of highway driving.
10 to 12 hours on a bus. That's a long day.
And your grand reward for all that travel time, you get a mere 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
15 minutes standing shoulder to shoulder on a crowded, heavily fenced in wooden viewing platform, literally fighting for elbow room to take a quick selfie with some rocks in the ocean. Oh, and by the way, due to natural erosion collapsing the pillars over the years, there are only 8 rocks left standing, not 12.
The 12 Apostles day trip perfectly encapsulates what travel economists call the express travel format.
Express travel format. What exactly does that mean in practice?
The modern travel industry has designed this highly efficient logistical system that actively forces tourists to consume vast, complex landscapes in these highly stressful, bite-sized, heavily scheduled chunks.
Just moving people like cattle?
Right. The industry optimization removes all context, all serenity, and all genuine connection to the geography. You aren't experiencing the majesty of the Great Ocean Road, which, by the way, is one of the most stunning coastal drives on Earth.
So I've heard.
But on the bus.
Yeah.
You are simply being transported as cargo to a designated photo opportunity zone, processed through a turnstile, and then immediately transported back to your hotel before sunset.
You know, it's like renting an epic, highly nuanced 3-hour cinematic masterpiece of a movie and just sitting on your couch watching it on fast forward the entire time solely so you can brag to your coworkers on Monday that you finished it.
That is exactly what it's like.
You saw the frames flash by, but you entirely missed the story. So how do we fix this? The local data is crystal clear. Skip the inner reef tourist traps like Green Island entirely. Do not waste your money.
What's the alternative for the reef?
Instead, drive north to Port Douglas and book a specialized high-speed catamaran that takes you all the way out to the outer reef near the continental shelf. Out there, the water is crystal clear and the coral is actually still vibrant, alive, and thriving.
And for the coastal drives?
Yeah.
How do you see the Great Ocean Road properly?
For the 12 Apostles, never, ever do it as a massive bus day trip. It is a miserable experience. Rent a car, take 3 or 4 days, and do a slow, multi-day self-drive along the Great Ocean Road.
That sounds lovely.
Sleep in the small coastal towns, and when you get to the Apostles area, spend your time at the lesser-known, equally spectacular limestone formations just down the road, like Camel Rock and the Bay of Islands, where you'll likely be the only person standing on the cliff face.
Now, while the coastal and marine regions suffer immensely from overcrowding and the degradation of that express travel format, if we look toward the deep center of the continent, the Australian outback, we see that it suffers from a completely different but equally powerful economic problem.
Okay, lay it on me.
We move from the economics of overcrowding to the economics of extreme isolation and total monopoly.
Let's talk about Yulara. This is the township also known as the Ayers Rock Resort, which serves as the primary and only base camp for visiting Uluru and Karajuda in the Northern Territory.
The isolation there is intense.
The sticker shock here is legendary in the travel community. We are talking about paying anywhere from $350 to $475 a night for an incredibly basic room.
For a basic room.
Multiple sources describe the architecture and vibe as a Soviet-style motel. The paint is peeling, the carpets are old. On top of that, there are hidden logistical fees for everything. Expensive shuttles, overpriced mediocre food.
And you can't even hike it off if you sleep in.
Right. If you think you're going to just wake up late and hike in the afternoon, think again. The hiking trails at nearby Karajuda are routinely shut down and literally locked with a gate by 10 in the morning because the extreme desert heat becomes a literal death sentence.
The pricing structure at Yulara is a harsh, real-world lesson in supply chain logistics and the economics of isolation.
Break down the numbers for me. Why does a bad bed cost $400?
Because of geography. This location is incredibly remote. It is hundreds and hundreds of kilometers from the nearest major supply chain, water source, or agricultural hub.
Just completely in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. Every single piece of food, every drop of fuel, every fresh towel, and every piece of replacement plumbing has to be trucked in across a massive, unforgiving desert.
Okay, so the overhead is insane.
Right. And because of this logistical nightmare, a single corporate entity, the Voyages Resorts Company, was able to establish and hold a total unchecked monopoly on all accommodation and services in the area.
Total monopoly.
Yes. When you pay $400 for that basic bed, you are not paying for luxury, high thread count sheets, or personalized service. You are paying exclusively for the incredibly complex logistics required to keep that bed operational in the middle of a hostile desert environment.
That makes sense, but it still hurts the wallet.
And crucially, you are paying for the complete lack of market competition. They charge those exorbitant rates simply because you, as a tourist, have nowhere else to safely sleep for a 3-hour drive in any direction.
You are a totally captive audience in the middle of a red dirt ocean.
Mm.
But speaking of the harsh realities of the desert, we have to talk about the seasonal illusions created by Instagram.
Oh, this is one of my favorite topics.
Because tourists aren't just getting tricked by pricing, they're getting tricked by biology. There is a place in South Australia called Lake Bumbunga.
The famous Pink Lake.
Right. If you look at social media, it is heavily, heavily advertised as this vibrant, magical, neon pink lake. It literally looks like a giant bowl of strawberry milk. It's stunning.
The photos are incredible.
So international tourists naturally put it on their must-see itinerary. They drive hours out there in the middle of the scorching summer. And what do they actually find?
Dirt.
A dull gray, blindingly white, completely dry salt pan. Nothing but dirt, salt, and crushing disappointment.
This is where complex biological reality violently collides with two-dimensional Instagram expectations.
How so?
Well, the pink coloration of these salt lakes is not a permanent geological feature. You know, it is not magic. It depends entirely on a highly specific, highly volatile biological mechanism.
What's the mechanism? Why does it turn pink in the first place?
It comes down to the presence of a specific species of halophilic or salt-loving microalgae called Dunaliella salina.
Dunaliella salina. Okay.
For this microscopic algae to bloom and actually produce that famous pink pigment, which is essentially just beta carotene, it requires a very precise, very delicate combination of seasonal water levels, extremely high salinity, and high UV light.
That's a lot of variables.
It is. The algae produces the pink pigment as a stress response, essentially acting as its own biological sunscreen to protect itself in the harsh, salty water.
Wait, so it's literally stressed out algae making a sunscreen?
Exactly. Mm. It is a fragile, highly seasonal phenomenon. If there's too much rain, the salinity drops and the water goes clear. If there is a summer drought, the water evaporates entirely and you are left with a white salt crust.
Nature does not operate on a guaranteed 365-day schedule.
No, and it certainly doesn't care about your tightly planned travel itinerary.
Nature doesn't use filters. It just does what it wants. So how do you beat the outback monopolies and avoid the seasonal traps?
Well, for the outback, the local advice is to skip the expensive resorts entirely.
What do you do instead?
Rent a fully equipped camper van or a 4WD with a rooftop tent. But crucially, you must stock up on all your groceries, bulk water, and jerry cans of fuel in the major coastal cities before you ever hit the desert.
Ah, so you completely bypass the corporate monopolies by carrying your own infrastructure on your back like a turtle. I love that. As for the Pink Lakes, the sources say only bother visiting the South Australian ones in the spring when the rainfall and evaporation levels are perfectly balanced. Or, if you are truly dedicated to getting that photo, make the massive trek over to Western Australia to see Hutt Lagoon.
Right. Our geological sources note that Hutt Lagoon is fed by marine springs and is much more stable and consistently pink year-round.
But here is where the industry gets truly cynical. If nature isn't cooperating, if the coral is dead, and if the landscape is too harsh to comfortably monetize, local municipalities will sometimes realize they can't rely on geography at all.
So what do they do?
Instead, they will just invent their own tourist traps entirely out of thin air.
Oh, right. The manufactured traps.
Which brings us to the fascinating world of manufactured heritage and tacky big things. I want to take a trip to Handorf, located in the otherwise beautiful Adelaide Hills in South Australia.
Handorf, a classic example.
Handorf relentlessly markets itself as a quaint, historic, highly authentic 19th century German pioneer village. You expect cobblestones, authentic bratwurst, and quiet charm.
And what's the reality?
The reality.
Yeah.
You are going to sit in multi-kilometer, bumper-to-bumper traffic jams just to get your car onto the main street.
Sounds relaxing.
When you finally manage to park, you'll be treated to overpriced restaurant food that our hospitality sources claim is frequently just pre-packaged and microwaved in the back to meet volume demands.
Microwaved schnitzel.
Yep. And the shops. They aren't selling local artisanal crafts.
Mm-hmm.
They are filled to the brim with cheap, imported, mass-produced souvenirs that have absolutely nothing to do with genuine German heritage.
It is the ultimate Disneyfication of history.
Disneyfication is the perfect word. And it gets worse when you look at how they treat actual historical figures. Look at the Ned Kelly Museum scattered around regional Victorian towns.
Ned Kelly being Australia's most famous outlaw.
Right, a really complex historical figure. But you've got places charging a $435 family ticket just so you can walk into a glorified corrugated iron shed and look at some rusty, generic 19th century farming tools that are only loosely speculative. Associated with him.
$400 to look at old tools.
Or go to the tourist wing of the famous Queen Victoria Market in Melbourne. Instead of authentic local crafts, it's just endless repetitive rows of cheap plastic boomerangs that literally have made in China stamped on the back.
It's just sad.
It is. But wait, before you move on, I have to ask you about a very specific, deeply weird Australian phenomenon that is all over this data.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. The big things.
Yes, the big things. The big pineapple in Queensland, the big banana in Coffs Harbor, the big merino sheep in Goulburn.
They are everywhere.
These are massive, multi-story concrete and fiberglass sculptures just sitting on the side of major highways. Now, I have to push back here because I see them on our list of tourist traps, but aren't these just free, quirky, harmless, highly lovable roadside stops?
You think so? Right.
I mean, how can it be a trap if you don't actually have to buy a ticket to stand in the parking lot and take a photo of a giant fiberglass banana?
That is exactly what makes them so economically effective. They're psychological traps rather than traditional admission fee traps.
Psychological traps? How so?
They operate as the physical, real-world equivalent of internet clickbait.
Clickbait. Okay, explain that.
The architecture of a roadside attraction is highly calculated. When you are driving the massive, monotonous distances between Australian cities, you suffer from highway hypnosis.
Sure, you just space out.
Right. So these giant, absurd pieces of brightly colored fiberglass are strategically designed and placed on long stretches of highway, specifically to force a cognitive break in your driving journey.
So they are giant visual speed bumps.
Precisely. The giant piece of fiberglass is entirely free to look at, yes. But the primary goal is to simply get you to turn off the engine and get out of your car.
And once you're out of the car...
Because once you are out of your car... Human behavior dictates that you will inevitably need to use the bathroom, stretch your legs, and suddenly you are spending $40 at the attached highly overpriced cafe.
Buying a coffee you didn't really need.
Filling up at the premium price fuel pumps and buying a plush banana at the gift shop. They monetize your fatigue.
Wow.
And as for places like Hondorf or the Ned Kelly exhibits, they represent the artificial exploitation of colonial history. They take genuine, complex, nuanced heritage and flatten it into an easily consumable, two-dimensional product. They basically turn history into a shopping mall.
Physical clickbait. Monetized fatigue. I will never, ever look at the big banana the same way again. It's brilliant, but it's sinister.
It really is.
So to avoid the heritage malls and the plastic boomerangs, what's the play? The locals say if you are at the Queen Victoria Market in Melbourne, entirely avoid the tourist merchandise wing. Do not even walk down those aisles.
Where do they go instead?
Hit the historic meat, dairy, and deli pavilions instead. Buy fresh oysters and local cheeses, where the actual working-class locals have been buying their food for over a century.
That sounds amazing.
And if you are in South Australia, skip the microwave pretzels and traffic jams in Hondorf. Drive just a few minutes further deep into the Adelaide Hills to towns like Stirling or Lenswood.
What's out there?
You get the exact same lush rolling hills, the exact same historic stone architecture, and incredible local produce, but with truly quiet, authentic local cafes and zero traffic jams.
It is always, consistently, about stepping just outside the highly illuminated, highly marketed zone of commercial tourism. The authentic experience is usually just one town over.
So what does this all mean? We've covered a massive amount of ground today, from the corporate monopolies of the Sydney Harbour Bridge to the hydrodynamics of Bondi Beach, all the way to the biological reality of pink lakes and fake German villages.
We really ran the gamut.
We did. And if we distill all of this raw data, all these reviews, and all this economic theory down, the primary lesson for you, the listener, is incredibly simple. You have to slow down.
Slowing down is key.
The entire global travel industry is built to rush you through a turnstile, extract your money, and get you back on a bus. You need to actively, aggressively avoid superlative marketing. If a billboard or an influencer is screaming that something is the biggest, the oldest, or the whitest, run the other way.
Run far away.
And remember the golden rule of local travel. If a specific place is globally famous and gridlocked, look at a map. Travel just 5 or 10 kilometers north or south along that exact same coastline or mountain range, and you will almost always find the real, uncrowded, pristine version of it.
That's great advice. If I can add one final layer to that, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as we wrap up this extensive analysis.
Me too.
Throughout this deep dive, we've talked extensively about physical traps, you know, overpriced desert resorts, crowded beaches, long bus rides, and fiberglass bananas. But look at the trajectory of the industry.
Okay.
With the modern rise of things like algorithmic tip-shaming QR codes at restaurant tables, the strict, heavily enforced corporate camera rules at public landmarks, and the ubiquitous Instagram filters that completely change how our brains expect natural biology to look, we have to ask ourselves a much deeper, more uncomfortable question.
What's that?
What is the ultimate tourist trap? Is it a specific physical location in Australia? Or is the ultimate trap actually the modern psychological compulsion to endlessly photograph, document, and prove to the internet that we were somewhere rather than actually experiencing the physical, flawed, beautiful world around us?
Oh, wow.
If we are ignoring the real beach to wait in line for the branded beach, who is really building the trap?
Are we trapping ourselves behind the lens? Are we the ones actively building the 2x4s behind the stage of our own lives? That is a fantastic, slightly terrifying point to end on.
Something to think about on your next trip.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Whether you are heading to Australia or just driving to the next town over, stay wildly curious, keep looking behind the scenery, and always, always question the travel brochure.